Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. July 26, 2015 marked the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, a landmark piece of legislation signed by President George H.W. Bush. The bill, sponsored by Senator Tom Harkin, was the most important piece of legislation impacting one-fifth of the population, who are people with disabilities. Disabled people form the nation's largest minority, and before the ADA became law, the notion that disabled people had civil rights was not universally accepted. Although today we take elevators and ramps for granted, it was a mere 25 years ago that the many aspects of accessibility and equal rights for disabled Americans was enshrined. Joining me today is Leonard Davis. He is the author of the new book, Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. Welcome to Uprising, Leonard.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I was very moved by the experience that you relate in the very opening of your book about your parents. Both your parents were deaf, and before the ADA, their lives were extremely isolating. Can you share a little bit of what personally motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, I was approached by Beacon Press to write the book to come out on the 25th anniversary of the Act. But personally, as a child growing up in a poor deaf family and an immigrant family, I was very aware of the injustices that were done to my parents. And I didn't put it in the book, but as a child, when we would ride on the subway in New York, I would stare at all of the people who were staring at my parents because they were using sign language. I would go from one end of the car to the other and stare them down. And then begin all over again, because I felt that my parents didn't really have their full civil rights. Life was difficult for them, and the only place that they were truly comfortable and accepted was within the deaf community.
So they didn't have access to so many things. We take sign language interpretation today at public events for granted. This is now something that's really important. How isolating was their life? And of course, by extension, that experience, I think, was typical for persons with disabilities before the ADA, right?
Right. For example, the simplest things that would be available even now to deaf people. But for example, if someone wanted to visit my parents, they would have to send my parents a postcard. My parents, we didn't have a telephone, obviously, no TTY or any means of communication. My parents had to send the postcard back saying, yes, we'll be at home at that point. The person would come to our house, often a deaf person. They'd ring the bell downstairs. And maybe 50% of the time, the jerry-rigged lighting thing that we had to turn a light on so that my parents would know that someone was downstairs and could let them in didn't work. So it's very possible that that person would just simply end up going home and my parents wouldn't have their guests. But that's only one thing. I mean, they weren't able to attend religious services. They couldn't, if they went to the hospital, if they went to the doctor, if they went to the court, there was no way for themselves to make their wishes known, except maybe tediously writing everything down on scraps of paper. It was a world. If they watched television, for example, I was the closed captioner. I was the one who had to tell them what the story was, because they couldn't. All they could do was see the images on the screen. So it was a very it was a world that was shut off to people like my parents who were profoundly deaf.
And also education opportunities, employment opportunities were severely restricted. And this, of course, has a direct impact on the ability of people to have a livelihood, which probably, of course, directly fed right into enormous poverty levels among people who have disabilities.
Well, it's true that people with disabilities are the largest minority in the United States. Even today, they are the poorest minority. Mm-hmm. When my parents were being brought up, they were sent to my father and mother were from England, and they went to the London Asylum for the Jewish Deaf and Dumb, I think it was called.
Wow.
They got a sixth grade education. They learned trades. So my father and mother both were tailors, essentially. But other trades could be shoemaker, working in a print shop, a linotype. But there was very little opportunity for deaf people to move above the trades. And they were assigned, basically, they were thought of as being low-paid factory workers.
So let's talk about the what led up to the ADA. The book that you write, Enabling Acts, tells a history that we that in great detail about what went on behind the scenes in the halls of Congress, in the White House, the kind of deal making that took place and wrangling that took place. Let's talk about the major players in Congress who crafted the bill and worked hard for years to pass it, and also were personally impacted by how poorly people with disabilities were treated. Can you tell us, for example, what motivated Senators Ted Kennedy and Tom Harkin to push for this bill?
Sure. Senator Kennedy had quite a bit of disability in his life. His sister, Rosemary, was born cognitively disabled. And she became even more cognitively disabled when Joe Kennedy, Ted Kennedy's father, decided to give her a lobotomy when she was a teenager, which really lowered her intelligence and her skills, motor skills, and so on. And she became virtually helpless and had to be institutionalized. Kennedy was aware of that very much so, and he was also aware of the of his son, clearly Patrick, who had his leg amputated from childhood cancer. Tom Harkin grew up in the Midwest on a poor farm with his older brother was deaf, and his older brother Frank was deaf, and Tom learned sign language and really understood the difficulties around his brother's life. I mean, actually, it was interesting because it also related to this issue about trades. He was being trained to be a baker, and he hated being a baker. And he was able to actually get a better job through some of his cunning that I describe in the book, Enabling Acts.
So the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law in 1990, but it was in 1965 that the Civil Rights Act was passed and signed. And the ADA was meant to enshrine civil rights for people with disabilities. Why wasn't the Civil Rights Act simply expanded to include persons with disabilities?
Well, that's an interesting story. you know, the original act actually didn't deal with gender either, and gender was included fairly soon after. But Hubert Humphrey, who had a Down syndrome grandson, decided that he was going to tack on an amendment to make the Civil Rights Bill apply to people with disabilities. And there was a very big pushback, actually, ironically, or maybe not so ironically, from the African-American community. They didn't want disability to be included. They felt that that would be kind of perverting the intention of the act, and also legitimately, I think they didn't want the bill brought up before the Senate and the House of Representatives because they felt it could have more damaging amendments added to it. So that early attempt that failed, and that's why it took another 20, 25 years before we got the ADA.
Now, what were the kinds of what were the kinds of coalitions that were formed on the ground, the kinds of grassroots activism that took place in the lead up to the passage of the ADA? I know that you write in your book that it was actually a lot of the lobbyists and people who were doing activism inside and outside the halls of Congress, but for that led to the ADA more directly. But for a minute, let's focus on some of the grassroots agitation. Of course, to organize at a time before the ADA must have been a huge challenge for persons with disabilities. As you mentioned, it was hard for your parents who were deaf to even make arrangements to meet other people, for those in wheelchairs without ramps. How did people overcome the challenges of organizing to organize for a bill that would make it easy to assemble and
well,
enjoy full lives?
Yeah. That's so such a good question, and we tend to forget now in the internet age how difficult it was to organize. I mean, obviously there were telephone calls. Deaf people couldn't use those, but there were teletypewriters, cumbersome devices that could use the telephone lines. There was a lot of faxing. Everyone I talked to, especially describing the lead up to 1990. Just said that they were faxing constantly. That almost seems antiquated to us now. But the interesting issue really is like I think around the I think we could say the 1960s, there wasn't really a sense that disability was an identity group and that they were a group that should or would have civil rights. I mean, there might be the blind person there and the deaf person here and the person in a wheelchair there, but they didn't necessarily have or see themselves as having anything in common. There were large organizations that dealt with specific disabilities. There's the National Association of the Deaf, there was the Association of the Blind, there was the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and so on. And each of those were lobbying for benefits for their for the people in that group, but they didn't necessarily form a coalition. And that the coalitions that came about politically really came about as the result of the aftermath of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. Because in that act, there was a very small, unknown almost, a kind of surprise section that was slipped in, and that really, if you look at the legislative history, was never discussed. No one even noticed it. It was only it's a tweet length quote. And basically what it said was that any person who is otherwise qualified could not be deprived of their civil rights. So that little section 504 became the basis for the idea that people with disabilities have civil rights.
And this was signed into
But
law by
however,
Nixon, the Rehabilitation
that's right.
Act. Yeah.
It was. Although one of the crucial things that we must not forget is that the act was really supposed to deal with the returning Vietnam vets and other people with disabilities. But there is a provision in the act that said, which is a very important idea for people with disabilities, that there should be funding for independent living. And the whole independent living movement was sort of like the SDS of disability rights. And independent living basically means, living in your home, not in an institution, and having funds for things that you need to live independently, maybe personal assistance, maybe an animal who helps you, maybe wheelchair or technology that will help you. So that money was in the bill, and Nixon vetoed the bill twice because he didn't want that money in there. And the third time, Congress took the money out, and then he signed it. So it was kind of a win and kind of a loss.
Right. So yet the part that remained, Section 504, that you identified as the this 46 words that changed history in your book, how did that then become the basis for the movement leading to the ADA? These words were in the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. It wasn't until 1990 that the ADA was passed. Did activists seize upon Section 504 to push for a broader set of rights?
Yeah, and I think what happened was word got out that there was this Section 504 and that regulations were being written. And one thing I didn't quite realize is you can write a law, but it doesn't take effect until there are regulations. So the regulations were being written, and they're actually very long and complicated. And it took practically 7 years between the law and the regulations being signed. So as word got out, that's when you got the beginning of these different groups recognizing that they had something in common now, which was to promote the regulations of 504 and get that working. So Nixon, as you know, left office, and Carter came in, eventually won the election. And everybody assumed that now, since Carter was a Democrat, the regulations would just, fire through. But they didn't. And Secretary of HEW, Califano, seemed to be sitting on them. So there were nationwide, so this is where the organization really started. There were nationwide demonstrations, city in every city in the major city in the United States. There was an occupation of the federal building, the HEW. But the one that everybody remembers was the San Francisco HEW building, which was occupied, I think, for 28 or 29 days. It was the longest occupation of a federal building in U.S. history. And they basically said, "We're not leaving until those regulations are signed." And Califano then signed the regulations. But it was in that lead up to that, and in the energy around those demonstrations, that there began to be a pan-disability movement.
And so, how challenging was it to then craft the ADA itself, this law, which ends up being a complex law, and I'm guessing it, of course, had to be complex because disabilities are extremely diverse. The needs of somebody in a wheelchair are quite different from the needs of somebody who is blind or has Down syndrome. How did legislators and lawmakers like Tom Harkin and Ted Kennedy and others involved, and of course their staff and lobbyists, how did they include everybody's needs? Where were the lines drawn?
Well, that's a good question, and you know, I think people don't realize it's easy to say, "Oh, America's a Disabilities Act," but this is probably one of the largest, most wide-ranging, most moving parts act passed in the 20th century. I mean, it does make the 1964 Civil Rights Act look like a much simpler act, because, as you said, there are so many things that have to be covered: transportation, communication, employment. Public accommodations. You just it covers, you know, almost everything that a citizen in the United States would do that would be part of their civil rights. So first of all, as you say, the bill had to be crafted. There was a small group that had been set up by Reagan, actually, which was called the National Council on Disability, and it was a group that was answerable. It was formed and answerable to the president. And that group, Reagan picked a whole bunch of people that he knew who were Republicans and who had some relation to disability. And it was ironically out of this kind of very heavily Republican group that the first draft of the ADA legislation came. And it was a rather radical piece of legislation, more radical than the current ADA. And people refer to it as the Flat Earth or the Flatten the Earth bill. Because it said essentially, like, all this stuff has to happen right away, and we have to remove every barrier immediately. So no, you know, so the world would essentially be flat for people with disabilities, particularly wheelchair users, is the metaphor. Mm-hmm. But that bill had no chance of passing. But it was a good talking point, and so when the bill came to actually come before Congress. Go to committee and come before Congress. It had been rewritten numbers of times by many different people, and there was much, as you said, wrangling, arm twisting. I mean, in the book, I describe in detail, in Enabling Acts, I describe in detail all of the politics of it, which is kind of fascinating, which is fascinating in and of itself. But the legislation. One way to think about it, and I this kind of rings a bell for me when I do think about it, because it's an interesting question politically. Why would conservative Republicans back a bill that looks like a increasing, you know, it looks anti-business, it looks like it's going to cost a lot of money, it's going to create
big
a lot
government
of
overreach, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Big. Why would, you know, and interestingly, if you want to talk about bipartisanship, I mean, this was a bipartisan bill. And a lot of, you know, conservative Republicans, including Orrin Hatch, who's still in the Senate, were for it. So, in other words, you could see the negotiations on one side as, you know, that the left is trying to protect people with disabilities as workers, as citizens. The right is trying to protect business from being sued under a law like the ADA. So there is this kind of interesting set of negotiations that happen in trade-offs.
And I'm sure there must have been quite a bit of discussion over the costs to businesses to retrofit their establishments that would put them out of business, to install ramps, etc. And how did those get negotiated and navigated? And I think the current ADA, as it is law, does, of course, carve out certain exceptions that were probably hard fought.
Yeah, I mean, actually, one interesting carve out is that no religious organizations are required to follow the ADA.
Wow, really?
Was a very effective lobbying directly to the White House on the part of many religions. There are complex issues about church and state also that fall into that, but they are carved out. But in terms of businesses, yeah, so there was one of the big fears on the right was that there'd be a, you know, a holocaust, I can't use that word anymore anyway, there'd be a conflagration of lawsuits, and that it would be very costly. The other there are other groups that fought back. One group was the universities, who obviously still are fighting back in the sense that they would have to do so much retrofitting. The transportation industry was screaming. I mean, the head of Greyhound was in every possible meeting arguing that it would be the end of long-haul buses. And municipalities fought very hard. The idea that they would have to put a wheelchair lift on every bus seemed to them impossible. And what's interesting now when we look back is that it's completely a completely normal part of our landscape now. But in those days, it just seemed like it was going to be impossible. So what were the compromises? There was a huge trade-off that was done in secret meetings, which I discovered. No one else has covered this. And the trade-off was that the left gave up the punishments that would come from lawsuits. They gave up a range of punishments. And the right gave up restricting public accommodations. So, like, way more public accommodations are included in the ADA than they were in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So that's interesting. That was one trade-off. The other is including two small words, double words. One is undue hardship or undue burden, and the other is reasonable accommodation. So the concept there was a business doesn't have to retrofit or doesn't have to do an accommodation if it would place an undue burden on the business. And by the way, the Flatten the Earth bill, the only reason that what their provision was, that the only way a business could not retrofit was if they were going bankrupt, if it caused bankruptcy.
But that was a more radical original version.
Yeah. So this version was undue
which
burden,
of course is a vague term where there's a lot of wiggle room for businesses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But on the other hand, it's true. I mean, you know, if you're a small, if you own a grocery store, and it's going to cost you a lot of money to do something. You know, you should have some kind of fallback position. The other is reasonable accommodation. So if the accommodation is reasonable, you'll do it. If it seems unreasonable, well, of course, these are words that just sent. The results of the ADA into court for a lot of cases, because these are all wiggle terms that need a judge to decide.
Mm-hmm. Now, Leonard, how important was even just the symbolism of the ADA passing, in addition to, of course, it dramatically improving in practical terms the quality of life of persons with disabilities, the fact that, and the concept that persons with disabilities had civil rights that they, you know, were born with and they had the right to, what sort of a cultural sea change did the ADA have on that front?
That is enormous. I mean, you know, when we look back on it 25 years later, the thing that jumps out is the idea that, you know, because if you had said to somebody in 1970, oh, you know, people with disabilities have civil rights, they would have said, no, they have rights to be rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. They have rights to have a prosthesis. But no, they don't have civil rights. Why would they have civil rights? So just the acceptance of the idea that people with disabilities are an identity group that have civil rights, I think, is enormous. And I think the respect also that comes from that, it can't be underestimated. Now we're used to seeing ramps, we're used to seeing closed captioning on TV, we're used to the wheelchair lifts. And as many people point out, those benefit not just people with disabilities, but they benefit everybody from the curb cuts. I mean, can you imagine back in the day saying, like, we're going to say that every single corner in every single town, in every single city, in every single state in the United States has to have curb cuts? You imagine people saying, like, that's impossible. How could you do that? It's a fact of life now. And it has the double use, skateboarders, people with strollers, people with wheelchairs, and so on. All of them have those abilities. People in bars that are noisy can watch the closed captioning. I mean, that idea is very, very important.
Yeah.
Also, I'm part of the baby boomer generation. You know, 56% of people over 65 have disabilities. So the reality is that these benefits will ultimately benefit a majority of the population if everybody has a chance to live long enough.
You know, finally, Leonard, one of the things that in the last few minutes of our conversation, the one of the things that jumped out at me that I was kind of shocked by was what you said, that the ADA, as it was written back then and in the late 80s and eventually signed into law in 1990, would not pass Congress today. Why?
Well, you know, I interviewed over 50 people for this book, Enabling Acts, and including, you know, major politicians. And every single one of them I asked, left or right, said that the ADA would never pass today.
Wow.
I mean, it would be seen, well, you know, I mean, it would be seen as big government, unfunded mandates, you know, in, you know, a lawyer's paradise. I think that's the case. And we have the actual example that the... there is, you know, the ADA, one of the things that was important is that it became the template for all of the disability laws around the world. And the UN fashioned a treaty on disabilities that included much of what was in the ADA, signed by every country in the world virtually, and ratified by every country except the United States. The United States has not ratified it. And under this Congress, and just last year and this year, they tried to get it through and they could not do it, because it was seen as UN telling us how to run our country.
And yet the ADA helped form the basis for this international treaty, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So the US paved the way, was a trailblazer in 1990, and then refused to ratify the international convention based on the ADA. I mean, that's crazy.
It is crazy, and it is a reality. I mean, Bob Dole, who now is in his 90s, you know, came out of Walter Reed Hospital to go to the floor of the Senate and tell and beg his colleagues, who many of whom knew him very well, to vote for the treaty, and they refused. So it just shows you that bipartisanship is kind of a fantasy, will never be a reality now under the present conditions.
Finally, also, Leonard, where does the ADA go from here? I'm sure it can use improvement, as any law can. Are there moves by the coalitions that are now probably stronger than they were before to improve the ADA, to make sure that it remains the law of the land, but also gets strengthened? You mentioned, for example, people with disabilities remain the most poverty-stricken group in the nation. That is
That's
a shocking statistic, and is there work being done to fix that?
Well, I'll say there are a number of things that are going on, including executive orders from President Obama. There is one bill which is actually, well, so the thing is, like, as the Republicans, I think I'll make that a party issue, want to shrink government and see benefit programs and what they call entitlements as a negative. The fear is that they'll cut back on the programs and the funding that's there. So there's definitely a movement
Medicaid.
To try to prevent that, possibly. The other thing is that, I'll give you a specific bill. It's kind of outrageous, but because of a 1938 act, there's something called sheltered workshops, and they permit people with disabilities to work for as little as 22 cents an hour. And Goodwill Industry, for example, has those sheltered workshops. They pay some of their workers 22 cents an hour, while their regional managers get more than $500,000 a year.
Wow.
So, and you know, so I think about that actually before you go to Goodwill. But the point is that the sheltered workshop concept has to end. People with disabilities have to get minimum wage.
Hmm.
That's just not negotiable.
Well, Leonard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and having this conversation with us. Best of luck to you with your book.
Okay, thank you very much, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Leonard Davis is the author of Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights.